Closure, part 7. My epigraph this time is from Johnny Nash's famous song. I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are those dark clouds that had me blind. Gonna be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. A few days after my transformative moment at Woodard Bay, a friend and former colleague from my days at Pitt, now teaching at the University of Virginia, stopped by with his new wife, who has family up on Bainbridge Island, about 60 miles north of here, for a walk and lunch. What a wonderful reunion that was, my first visitor from my Pittsburgh-based past. A few months ago, he asked me to join his class via Zoom to talk with the students about the first book I wrote after Carol passed, this fall, my Keystone book, which he was teaching in a course on memoir. I had such a blast with those young people who were so kind and generous and receptive to me and my work. A month or so after that, my sister-in-law sent me a link that came up in her Google feed to an article in the University of Virginia campus newspaper, written by one of the young women in that group. She had lost her mother devastatingly just 6 months before my visit. I had no idea about any of that when I met the group, but I remembered her quite vividly, upper middle left square on my Zoom screen. Not so much for what she said, but for the intensity of her presence, her attentiveness, which often communicates much more than words. I recall, after one of her questions, asking her simply if she liked the book, a question I rarely ask because it shifts the focus to me and kind of prescribes the response. Few people are likely to say no. But for some reason, I felt a kinship with her and just wanted to know her honest opinion, which I knew I would get. She said yes. In her article, she describes the salutary impact both my book and my visit had for her, calling attention to my mantra that however few readers I have, I am always thrilled when one of my books reaches the right person at the right moment. It's raison d'etre, I believe, which seemed to be the case here. She concludes this way. Camille's positivity and radiance made me feel hopeful for the future. Before reading his book, the future seemed more bleak and uncertain to me. He talks about his journey of rediscovery and finding himself after his wife's passing. I haven't embarked on that journey yet. It still feels a bit too early for me. At the same time, however, I also feel like I have the potential to do so. His book touched me. It's not every day when I feel like I can personally connect with the content of a course so deeply. As a result, it has made the learning process much more gratifying. However, in this particular case, it's not medieval English texts that I'm learning about. Instead, I'm learning more about myself. I was stunned. No one, I mean ever, has attributed radiance to me. And to be instrumental in generating some hope in someone disconsolate over a grave loss is beyond compare in the range of my aspirations. In that moment, I knew I and my book had found her, and that I and my book had also been found. And because she is inseparable from those two, I knew Carol had been found as well. This changed my life. Maybe more than it changed hers, helping me also, I now see, redeem my own bleak and uncertain into hopeful. It's possible that everything that has happened recently is a result of this simple interaction. My friend had not seen the piece, so was interested in finding this out, a way for him too to understand the sometimes invisible but dramatic impact of his work. Most days, I like to wear at least one ring. I have an assortment of wedding rings to choose from. The one I put on when I married Carol, the one that replaced it about 20 years later when my ring finger got too large for it, and a couple from my Uncle Joe Carrick's estate, one marked 1900, so most likely his father's, one a delicate braiding of gold that may have been his. I most often avoid putting one on my left ring finger, given its cultural symbolism. I'll try them on until one fits just right on that day on one of my other fingers, not too tight, so I can slide it off when I want to, not too loose, so it won't fall off while I'm walking, all of which varies from day to day and season to season. Last week, the only one that fit perfectly anywhere was my second wedding ring on my left ring finger. I've worn it there comfortably every day since and will continue doing so as long as I can. It will, I know, be read by most women as a gesture that I'm still irrevocably devoted to Carol, long past now, the love of my life. Like most of the ways others interpret, I mean misread, me and my public gestures, that is only partially true. There were long stretches while we were married that I didn't wear a ring, the period between rings when my first one didn't fit and we couldn't quite afford a second one, the long summers when I did heavy-duty outdoor work at one or another of our homes, the kind that would damage a ring or the finger to which it was attached, or when I was doing woodworking, building things, same issue. I never, during those interims, felt the slightest twinge of guilt about this. I was married to Carol, and that was simply foundational to my being and my life. When you need a ring to remember that, or gesture that to others, I think that's a problem. So now, what does this ring do? Well, first of all, it will be off-putting to any woman who won't invest the time or energy getting to know me because she believes I'm already taken in the way she is looking to take someone. I have no problem with that at all, a sort of efficient weeding-out device. Second of all, it remains a gesture to Carol, who did take the time and energy not only to get to know me, but to marry me. I honestly believe that if I had been wearing a wedding ring when I met her, she either wouldn't have noticed or wouldn't have been deterred, figuring I was interesting enough to get to know and love even if I wasn't available that way. It's possible I may still meet people willing to make that investment and risk just to enjoy my company. But most importantly to me, it is a symbol to remind me that last week I found myself again, the way I did almost 70 years ago, on the top step of that back porch in Pennsylvania, bonded 2-to-1, male and female, my dual identity as it is everyone's at that age and can be forever if they want. And then again, over and over, throughout the course of our amazing life, me, finding me on a sunlit wall or a long walk, receive, giving, everything that matters, from the inside out, from the outside in, past and future, fully present, right here, right now, in their all-at-onceness, enveloping us in a welcoming aura of selfless love. I'll end with this poem I wrote a little more than a year ago on Valentine's Day, which seems as if it is pertinent to all this. Called Think, and Think is the first word of the poem as well. Think what it might mean today to say out loud, I love you. If you are alone walking in the woods among winter trees, their svelte, delicate arms outreaching so openly, they will smile, understanding. Never say, I love you back, knowing you will know that everything they know about love is in words that cannot be heard. Except we will be here when you come back tomorrow, lovingly, by yourself, with us, another ordinary day. You may say, I love you all day long to children. the glossy wings of those words gliding perfectly through the crystalline air, a bright white wedge dissecting the bluest of skies, swooping to a soft landing in the greenest grass that grows in that wide field at the top of the hill where you always end your imagined walks with them together. And you may say them smilingly to any passerby on the street who will assume a lunacy of loneliness or the out-of-tuneness of Jesus, sounding loose, even stupid, so barren there in the open air when they cast eyes askance and walk past at an obtuse angle as if they cannot hear, or nod smilingly to say silently, safely, thank you, even if I can't now know for sure or say that I love you too. Be wary, though, with those who barely know you, out there in the marketplace of giving and taking, wanting and needing, where those three words are a worrisome currency. Care there is imperative. Say, I love you, even beneath your breath, and those who overhear will tighten, recoil slightly, eyes dipping, tiny invisible anxieties gripping the corners of their lips, tipping them down. But always, and I mean always, in the lush hidden chambers of your own heart, where you speak to yourself ceaselessly, say, I love you, over and over, an endless loop, as if those are the only three words you still remember, ever need to hear or to think.